Cassette tape radio.
Welcome to Cassette Tape Radio bonus episode. I'm your host, Talia Randall. This little bonus episode is an interview I did with Toby Campion, who is the director of a poetry organisation called Unislam. If you've listened to the previous episode, episode number 8, then you'll know all about this. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, I recommend that you do. And in this interview, we talk about lots of things. We talk about poetry, we talk about the spoken word scene in which both Toby and myself sort of started out. And I say the word absolutely, absolutely, yeah, yeah, absolutely, a lot to everything that Toby says. That's it. Enjoy the interview. So to start off, just tell us about yourself. Who are you, babe?
I'm Toby Campion. I'm a poet, playwright, writer, performer, host, producer.
No big deal. Just one of them.
I'm like, what am I? What actually am I? Yeah, I do writing basically, and gigs, and also facilitating other things and facilitating poetry-based events and programs.
Lovely. How have you been finding that during the lockdown, especially because so much of your stuff has been live?
Yeah.
How are you managing?
Do you know what? It's been quite nice. I've had a break from doing gigs. I've only done one gig during the lockdown. And I've actually really enjoyed not doing gigs. I mean, I love doing them normally, but it's been nice to have just a bit of a break and to be a little bit more reflective and try and do a bit more writing and that kind of thing. So I've actually quite enjoyed that. It's been a bit trickier to do you know, producing live events with people there, because you can't really do that. But so we've kind of changed some of the stuff that we had planned. We were going to do some work with schools through Unislam, but we've had to kind of change that now. And but it's been quite good to think about ways in which we can work online more in the future, and actually it makes a lot of the stuff more accessible for more people in some ways, or you can reach more people with recordings of stuff. So it's been quite good, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it, how all the stuff around access is just conversations I've had with a few people online. It's in some ways more accessible, in some way less accessible, but it's these questions the mainstream are asking themselves a little bit more about access. I'm calling us the mainstream, by the way. That's quite a bold statement.
Absolutely not mainstream.
But people who might not always have to think about access are suddenly thinking about it, which hopefully will then translate to things being more accessible after this, you know? But
yeah. And it was also, I think, quite interesting, because at the start, everyone was just putting out loads of stuff for free, and like workshops for free, and you know, we did a series of free workshops, but they were funded through Arts Council. But I applied for the Arts Council funding and
the emergency funding.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, how are you gonna think about your practice? And I was like, well, I wrote about thinking about how to create an income from stuff online, and it just, I don't know, I kind of think it's difficult when everything, I think the immediate reaction was to kind of make everything free and make everything accessible for people, and kind of like enter the spirit of the lockdown by being, you know, making everything open. But also on the flip side of that, then it's really difficult for people to monetize or get any kind of earn any kind of living from the stuff that they would have been earning a living from before by doing it online.
Exactly.
So I think
isn't it?
Yeah, tricky.
And it's hard because people have, some people may potentially be not better off, but if they're furloughed or whatever, they're not spending money on travel or whatever, lots of people are obviously clearly much worse off. So it's thinking about the ask in a new way as well, I think, is going to be a question we're going to have to keep asking ourselves, I think. Especially when, like, most of my work is subsidised. So it's either through the Arts Council or through a theatre that's subsidised through the Arts Council. It's generally not direct me and a consumer.
Yeah.
But that's kind of changing, I think, now. So, yeah, you're right. I think lots of people are thinking about that in a new way.
Yeah. And also, we think about these workshops or things online being accessible, but also there's lots of people who can't access things online and thinking about that.
Absolutely.
As well.
And just not having internet access or not being able to use a computer or having a shared computer or having the bandwidth taken out because everyone at home is working or all these other things are important things that we have to consider. Well, that was great. That was just the first question and we went off into loads of different tangents. So that's great.
Okay, great.
I should probably ask at this point what UniSlam is.
Yes. So UniSlam, for people who don't know what a poetry slam is, so a poetry slam is a competitive poetry event where people get up and they perform poems and they're then scored by the audience or by a panel of judges. And the higher scores progress onto the next round and so on until there's a winner. So UniSlam is the UK National University Poetry Slam and Summit. So it's an annual event and we get teams from universities across the UK and Ireland coming together to compete in the Varsity Poetry League, basically. But the festival it's not just the slam, there's also lots of workshops and talks and fringe events for the participants and other people as well.
Great. So there's all this other activity that's sort of built around this main event, this main slam and competition and sort of... Because it's quite a prestigious thing to win a slam in many ways, isn't it? It can help get you noticed. It can help develop your practice.
Yeah.
So it's great that there's all these other things connected to it. So it's about that, but it's not just about that. It's about a whole lot.
Yeah, exactly. And I think UniSlam is really community focused. And I think a lot of slam claims to be that, but I genuinely believe that UniSlam is really more focused on community building and thinking about developing the people who are part of it. So as part of UniSlam, all the participants get feedback if they want it from judges, access to loads of workshops, and chances to see people perform that they might not otherwise be able to see perform, people from different regions or professional poets. So a lot of it is, and also the structure, how we structure the prizes. So there are certain prizes that don't necessarily go to the highest scoring team. We do individual prizes. So kind of shifting the focus away from this idea of like a winner. The team that scores highest are the best and therefore worthy of, you know, accolades or attention or whatever.
Yeah.
And thinking about ways in which we can divert that a little bit. So, and we've taken teams to the equivalent competition in America called Cupsy. We took about four teams over the years. So that was also an experience.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. Overseas trip.
Yeah,
I miss those. Not that I go on many anyway. I'm suddenly like, oh my god, I want to book an airplane ticket. Like, I don't. That's definitely not what I do anyway. But I want to be in an airport.
Yeah.
I'm Talia Randall. You're listening to Cassette Tape Radio. Do you like what you're hearing? If you do, like, subscribe, share the episode with a friend, leave us a lovely review. That really, really helps. And if you're able to, please consider donating, maybe chuck us a £5 tip. The link to my PayPal is in the episode description. Also, a transcript of this episode and all the episodes are available in the link in the episode description. So this episode is like a bit of a UniSlam takeover in a sense that we've got a bunch of poems from fantastic poets.
Yeah.
Both you and me included, babe, of course, in what... is called a mid-career or post-emerging cohort. None of us are in uni. Some of us haven't been to uni. So what's that program about and what's its connection to UniSlam?
Yeah. So as well as the annual festival, UniSlam also runs programs throughout the year. So one of those, for example, we do workshops with young people in the Midlands who face various barriers in accessing literature and education. And this past year, we received some funding from Arts Council to work with people who are, as you say, post-emerging or mid-career, which is a bit of a weird, I don't know, the terminology.
What does it mean?
What does it mean? Basically, I think it means people who have left the emerging stage of their practice, the initial stage of their practice, and kind of also on top of that, the associated 16 to 25 age bracket.
Right.
I think there's a lot of funded opportunities and development opportunities for people that are age 16 to 25 and also people that are right at the start of their career. But for people who have been artists who have been working for a while and released one or more bodies of work, either published or performed, there's actually not that many funded opportunities for them to keep developing their practice.
Because apparently we figured it all out. Do you know what I mean? We've been to a couple of workshops and it's just like, yeah, we know what we're doing. So we don't need any of that development at all, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. and even really great places that provide really amazing opportunities for people in that age bracket, there isn't really, it's kind of a cut off after that when you reach 26.
Yeah.
It's just kind of see you later. And I know the Roundhouse are really thinking about that a lot because they have really great programs for 16
to 25 amazing
year
stuff.
And so that's partly why we partnered with them. So the Roundhouse also support the program. The post-emerging mid-career program, yeah. So it's basically we support a group of poets who identify as mid-career. So we did a series of workshops and mentoring sessions and peer workshops. And it's I guess, similar to the festival, it's about building a community amongst those people and hopefully one that then becomes self-sustaining, which I think it has really in the lockdown. I mean, you know, we've carried on with meetings kind of off our own back.
We've had meetings every week when we just sort of share. We have a little chat and a moan at first, which is really lush.
Yeah, the grumble.
So nice. Yeah, we have a little mini grumble on Zoom and then we present our poems and just give each other feedback. And we were talking about how nice it has been to have that during, because we were planning on doing that anyway, but to have that since this whole lockdown social distancing situation, I think has been really great for a lot of us because it feels still quite gentle. It's not, everyone kind of knows each other's work a bit by now because we've had, you know, a couple of months of already having worked together. So it feels really considered and lush, basically.
And it's really nice, babe, to invest in other people's work as well beyond your own and invest time in people's work who you care about. And I really enjoy doing that.
Absolutely. Like, I think writing the feedback on other people's work has taught me just as much, if not more, about receiving feedback. It's been brilliant. I forgot what I was gonna ask. I feel like you said something that was, we said lots of brilliant things, but I feel like you said one particular thing that I wanted to be like, it'd be interesting as well just to hear you talk a little bit about the difference between emerging and 16 to 25 or 11 to 25, because sometimes they're assumed to be the same thing.
Yes,
but actually lots of people emerge from the cocoon, the artist cocoon, when they're much older.
And that was actually also at the start when we were coming up with the program and what the offer would be. We were kind of deciding between whether to work with people who were still emerging but were older emerging artists, or whether to work with kind of post-emerging or mid-career poets, which is what we ended up doing. But I was also really interested in thinking about those people who come to writing later or for whatever reason are I guess developing or beginning their practice at a later age, and providing,
or maybe come
something
from a different art form or something.
Yeah,
so maybe
exactly
they've written or performed or whatever, but are just starting poetry and spoken word in their 40s, 50s, whatever.
Or even like a different career, or
exactly.
Know, yeah, something completely different, and yeah, exactly, that are then coming to it. Later on, and for whom those opportunities for 16 to 25 year olds who are emerging aren't available for them. But we in the end decided to do something for post emerging, that or that kind of category. But it's something that I'm still really interested in figuring out an offer for, because it is something that we lack, and I think we lack something for that, and we really lack something for this post-emerging or mid-career group, which is why we set it up. I mean, there's, you know, Toast Poetry was around for a couple of years with Lewis Buxton and Georgina and a couple of other programs, but apart from that it's kind of like Arvon, which is very expensive, or a degree.
Absolutely.
So it's really difficult.
And there was also a sort of, it felt very informal, which was really nice. So there are some great courses that I've done, amazing courses at the Poetry School, for instance, and they've been brilliant. But it still feels like you're going to a course it's felt a lot more free-flowing, the sessions. I think it's because there were whole day sessions and we're a bunch of gobby idiots. I say that with the highest compliment. If someone called me a gobby idiot, I would take that as a compliment, so no offense to any other poets who feature on this podcast. It is true. You're listening to Cassette Tape Radio, a mixtape style podcast featuring comedy, poetry and interviews like this one.
Poetry before us was kind of quiet, you know. You might have had tea and crumpets, you know, and sat around and maybe whisper to each other. You didn't talk too loud. And then we put brass knuckles on it and punch you in the face with poetry. Mm. We gave it a rowdy sound. You know, we turned up the volume. And it became a war cry in many ways for a lot of people.
Episodes are out every other Thursday, so like, subscribe, and carry on listening. So in your career, from emerging to post-emerging to post-lockdown in the future, it's going to be a new thing, post-lockdown. What are some of the changes that you've seen in or experienced in poetry and spoken word? So some of the changes that have been really good and positive, and some of the changes that you think, that's not so great.
Yeah. I'm not 100% sure, because I guess was emerging. I lived in America for a little bit and was doing open mics and early slams and stuff there. And then I moved back to Edinburgh. So I was kind of doing more open mics and my first kind of gigs there, and then moved back to Leicester and then moved to London. So I kind of feel like I've not been in one consistent space to observe the spoken word culture there. And I feel like it's actually quite different in different places.
Massively.
Yeah. So I kind of feel like, I don't know if I have an observation about the change over time in a particular place. But I do think it's, this poetry scenes and the spoken word scenes are weirdly different in different places. And I think I came to London with a bit of a, not a chip on my shoulder, but an awareness that everything is quite London centric, which is why we've never hosted Unislam in London, and we intend hopefully to not do that, so that
Fantastic.
It's easier for other people to get to. So I kind of came here with that in mind, but at the same time have really enjoyed all of the opportunities that have been afforded to me by being based in London at the moment. So it's a bit tricky.
It's really challenging, isn't it? Because that's such an important conversation, and you're right. Everything is London centric. Really sorry about that, by the way.
Yeah.
But it's also as part of that conversation, it's also the London has some of the highest levels of poverty in the whole of the UK. So it's about making sure that the opportunities that do exist are not just accessible, but actively seeking out those people who wouldn't normally go to those opportunities or know about those opportunities.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it as well, because often it doesn't feel like that. And there are some places and venues who are doing that really, really brilliantly. We've mentioned the Roundhouse already. There's many others.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of marrying those two things, isn't it?
And it's doing the work. You have to do the work to do that, which is difficult, and it is and it is hard. But I think, I think you're right. That's spot on.
Yeah, for sure. And especially because so much of, you know, austerity has really completely dismantled a lot of really great work that had been done previously. So a lot of arts, because I work a lot in the arts, I also work in the education sector, and have really noticed that arts centres are having to take on a lot of the pastoral or support or welfare work that would have been done by a local authority or a charity or something.
Yeah.
And so many people have just really taken on those other jobs. But it shouldn't have to be that way.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's going to be really tricky once we come out from this, because who knows where the arts center, who knows where the arts sector is going to be in a couple of months' time or a year's time or whatever. So
And it, touching on that and thinking about how things have changed, I've been writing a chapter on slam at the moment, and it's really made me think about the elders in our community and in spoken word and in poetry, but in poetry, but particularly the people who were out there right at the start pushing spoken word and pushing the importance of poetry being performed with a crowd just as much as it being on the page, and kind of thinking about how we honor those people and just thinking about them more and their legacy and celebrating them.
Absolutely.
You know, people like seeing Roger Robinson winning, you know, T.S. Eliot and the awards that he's winning now, and those people getting recognition for those things, and Joelle Taylor and and everybody. I've been thinking about that quite a lot recently, and the ways in which events that we're programming now, for example, Unislam, involving those people and making the young people that are coming up aware of the work that came before them. And I think we've always done
that
in Islam. We've always had you know, a real mix of people and backgrounds and experiences as judges and facilitators, but I think that's a real important part of the work.
You're listening to Cassette Tape Radio, a mixtape style podcast. Each episode totally different to the next. Interviews, comedy, original music, and poetry like this.
We've been made homeless in language, kicked out of our own word. A community centre so hostile that we clumsy through umbrella terms.
If you're working class, you inherit anger. If you're middle class, you inherit manners and a house.
Snap poll. Which racist do you want on your banknote? They give you the default sitar solo, aka Indian banjo. Fuck. Election time. Gotta hang low. This guy's telling me to go back home. Type NW2, what does your sat-nav show?
Proverbs for a woman drinking alone. If a woman drinks undisturbed in a forest, does she even exist? A man walks into a bar and ruins the woman's evening.
Don't push me. I'm close to the edge. At the end of my tether, whatever the weather, whatever the method, it's all in my effort not to... Oh, I'm doing 10 toes. The grindstone never left my nose.
I was not born under a rhyming planet. I was born a conclusion to her motherhood. Premature, spitting fire from belly, shattering uterus, taking her womb out into the world with me.
And it wasn't until I saw someone on stage rapping away with words that I've used every day for years that the tears started rolling. There was no control and my mind was unfolding, beholding the true nature of what I had lost. Then not reading books is not the real cost.
Make sure you subscribe, share it with a friend, leave us a review and carry on listening. So many of these people sort of paved the way for us. And I think we often take for granted the fact that so many audiences are used to, in inverted commas, being in a spoken word crowd or a poetry crowd, because the sort of expectations that come with different art forms can often prevent people from coming to a gig in the first place. But when you're kind of pioneering an art form and people aren't really sure about what you're doing, you have to kind of steal a little bit of space in a club or a pub or whatever and just do your thing. Whereas now, you know, you run a massive festival every year that's massively attended, and that's, like you're saying, so much of that is owed to people kind of having to swim upstream and get audiences interested and involved in this incredible art form.
And it's interesting as well, getting, you know, I try and book features who are people that have been around for a while and who are big, but also who kind of embody that idea of legacy. But yeah, it's interesting that some of the younger people at Unisound don't know those people. Or even we had Holly McNish a couple of years ago. Holly McNish did the first one that I took over Unisam years and years ago, and then we got her back last year. But some of the young people didn't know her, and I was like, she's like really, but she's like really big now. I think it's important.
Absolutely. I think with any art form, it's the more you kind of know about the ins and outs and what's happening right now and what happened 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, whatever, is so important. But I also think it speaks to this thing of like, what does a spoken word or poet's career look like? Because it's so much more unknown than, say, I mean, everything in the arts is unknown and a lot of it's up to chance or existing privilege or whatever. But there's a kind of trajectory in, I don't know if I'm saying that just because this is my job, but it feels like with other art forms, there might be a bit more of a set path sort of. And maybe with spoken word or the type of poetry that is kind of happening now, it seems less clear. So I wonder if that means that people's knowledge of what came before is therefore has more holes in it. Because you might not know where to go to find spoken word history. Do you know what I mean? Other than a few organisations who kind of do that really well, there's not a big... Whereas you could like really... You could Google the career of an actor or an actress or a musician. And even that's not conventional, obviously. But you could maybe think, oh, I could do this, this and this. Whereas for what we do is a bit more, you have to be a bit more wily. I don't know. Who am I? What am I doing?
And because people go off and do different things and go into playwriting or go into, you know, songwriting or, you know, or just a completely different career. And also it's the kind of the nature of slam in this country anyway, I think, is kind of, it's seen a bit more as a rite of passage and a bit more of a thing that you do when you're starting out and you don't kind of continue with, whereas in other places I don't think that's as much the case.
It's true,
but that means that then there aren't these people that are kind of continually around in the slam scene and therefore people recognize or know them. And also part of it is, I think, you know, because poetry and particularly poetry that's performed or spoken word is about, I've got something to say and I'm going to say it now and I need to say it and I'm getting out there and saying it, that actually in some ways it's great that those young people aren't bogged down by, you know, needing to know who their elders are or need, you know,
for sure,
letting that hold them back. I mean, I think obviously that it, you know, that only holds true to a certain extent, and you know, when you get to a certain place you need to be reading a lot more and thinking a lot more about that.
Yeah.
But I also think actually it's great to have that attitude of just like, well, I'm here and I'm doing it and I'm not, you know, I don't need permissions from people. Yeah. And I don't
the
need
the gatekeepers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think that sense of urgency is so important. I just think it's even more compelling when it's rooted in sharing or just finding out more. And I think also the thing that's really important is that, like, that knowledge or whatever that we might want to know or find out more isn't just one thing. So there's not just one canon, is there? So there's lots that we definitely, you and I absolutely, I mean, there's so much I don't know, babe.
Oh, yeah.
Just in life.
Yeah. I know. But I'm like, things, we should know all the old people. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I know everyone.
Yeah, yeah,
but in terms of what's happening now, what happened 5 minutes ago, 5 years, 50 years ago, whatever, because there's obviously some voices who have still been uplifted, but there's loads of others that have been lost, especially because, you know, the ease of which we record things now, we don't even think about it. I mean, we're doing this podcast remotely on a phone and a dictaphone, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when, even when I was starting out, I had some crappy brick phone. So getting something filmed felt really like special.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's amazing because there's so much more that you can do to get your work out there, but there's so many voices that just haven't been recorded in that way. That would be a really interesting project. Maybe we'll send this direct to the Arts Council and be like, when you're giving out money again, can you do a hidden histories?
Well, I'm reading a book at the moment actually that kind of it's really great. Let me get the book so I can actually say it right, but it kind of touches on that. It's called How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by, hold on, edit out the big pause. Where is it?
What if I want to leave in the big pause, babe?
You can leave it in.
Thanks.
It's by Alexander Chi. How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. And it's kind of like a series of fragment or chapter essay bits that are really cool, and one of them is him in a queer bookstore cataloguing this new collection of queer poetry that was queer poetry and fiction and prose and all kinds of writing that was taken over by this particular bookshop, and him talking about how it was amazing to see, you know, these people who had been so influential in his works, like, you know, James Baldwin and Audre Lorde and these people, but also how many other people had written stuff and they just weren't captured by the mainstream or weren't picked up or weren't listened to, and how powerful that was for him, and seeing for every, you know, Audre Lorde, there's 10 people that were also saying important things about queer issues and other things, but just weren't listened to or heard.
You're absolutely right.
So it was really interesting.
I think that's
really
why.
Interesting to,
sorry, go on.
No. Yeah, it's just really interesting to
might borrow that book.
Perspective on that.
I think that actually comes a lot of spoken words impulse. You were talking about that urgency earlier. Comes from wanting to record that nowness.
Yes.
Definitely with The Night That I Run, What Words Are Ours? I feel like it's trying to be a snapshot of what's happening now with deaf and hearing poets, because I mean, you've performed, you've been to the night before, but there's no headliner as such. Everyone gets the same amount of time on stage, and people are very intentionally representing very different styles and ways of performances, because it's sort of meant to be this is just a snippet of all the things that exist now. Some people are quite well known in our scene, some people are well known beyond the scene, and others aren't as well known as they should be. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing of being, hey, we need, let's just take stock and see what's there. Because like you said, for every one brilliant person, there's 10 brilliant people. And all of those voices deserve to be listened to.
Yeah, and What Words Are Ours does that so well, I think. I always think that. And that it never feels tokenistic or never feels gimmicky. It's
That's good.
It really feels like, a snapshot and just a cabaret of these amazing people that are doing really interesting different things that are all equal to one another.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes it can feel like there's a hierarchy of styles or ways of saying things. And in my world, there really isn't, you know, because that any kind of hierarchy is inherently wrong anyway.
Yeah.
Because you're elevating one, essentially one culture above another, because there's so much of poetry and spoken word is rooted in our own personal cultures, whatever that means. So.
And even, even within poems, within poetry itself, I mean, bringing it back to this idea of slam, it's how do you judge a poetry slam? I mean,
absolutely,
you know, it's so subjective. The idea of judging one poem against another is ludicrous in some ways. So it is, there, you know, there can't ever be an objective hierarchy of these things
for sure. I've judged the Roundhouse Slam a couple of times and it's always so, I love it, but I'm also so overwhelmed by it. I know I have judged the final because it's so difficult, like you said, just to kind of condense everyone's work. And so what parameters do you choose to go from? You know, it's almost like you have to just arbitrarily choose a set of parameters and just
stick with those. And getting out, and getting rid of this idea of what poetry at a poetry slam should be, or what, or this idea that slam poetry exists, which it doesn't, because you can perform any poem at a poetry slam. A poetry slam is a movement, it's not a genre.
Absolutely.
And I think the Roundhouse Slam does that really well as well. Getting rewarding work that's just quality work rather than the work that feels like it's trying to fit a certain thing or mold itself into what it should be, what it feels like it should be in a slam setting.
For sure. I guess slam's really just about being able to just hone your voice, whatever that is, and just being able to get it out clearly to a group of people. I suppose that's really, I've just condensed it. I've just done it for you. I'll copyright it. Yeah.